Before we begin, that's fine, go ahead. I just want to, I know that we have two Mr. Tates here.
I'm George Tate, Your Honor, and I'll be arguing the case, the appeal.
You're going to argue the case?
Yes, Your Honor.
Let me see, Mr. Tate, are you the counsel from Louisiana or counsel from Colorado?
I'm the counsel from Louisiana, Pro Hac Vitae.
Okay. And you're going to argue for the appellants in this case?
That's correct, Co-West Telluride, Your Honor.
All right. And then we have the Kells and the Browns. Are we going to have separate counsel for those parties?
My name is Michael Gilbert, I'm appearing for the appellee Stuart Brown, who's here in the courtroom. And this is Mr. Kell, who's going to be arguing on behalf of the Kells.
Okay, and you're going to decide how you want to split your 15 minutes?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you.
And I would like, I think I was trying to get it into 10 minutes and a rebuttal of five, but I think it'll probably be about 12 minutes.
Okay.
If I...
Well, I'll try to...
Is it gonna, is it, this will show the time? This digital thing is...
It should, does the time show right there?
It shows 15.
Yes, once we start, it'll start counting down.
Okay, that's fine, Your Honor. I'll adjust accordingly.
The yellow light means 5 minutes left.
That's right. I didn't realize there's a digital readout as well, so...
Now, one other thing that I did not mention at the beginning of the first case, we have read everyone's briefs, and at least one of us has read and delved into the record. So we're very familiar with the facts of the case. And if you would like to go to the legal issues, that may be helpful because of the limited amount of time available. But of course, your argument is yours. You can address it any way you want.
I appreciate it, Your Honor.
Just a suggestion.
Okay. And there's so many facts in this case. I understand. I appreciate the suggestion, Your Honor.
Okay. You may proceed whenever you're ready, Mr. Tate.
Okay. May it please the court. Your Honor, this matter involves a sale of Co-West Insurance Agency, a family-owned agency operating out of Telluride with a branch at Norwood. The sale was made, as you know, by the consideration for the sale was a $325,000 promissory note, the purchase money note, the first note, together with a $25,000 side note. The first note, of course, had guarantees or accommodation parties. They had Mr. Brown and they had Mr. Greenberg, DBA, the Performance Group, which is an unregistered partnership of some kind, allegedly, although there wasn't anybody else in the office, which went into liquidation on January 8th, 1999, on Exhibit C-199. This was within about two months of the sale, just over 2 months after the sale. Mr. Greenberg himself was not seen by my client or pretty much anyone in town, anyone else in Telluride, having left the state right after signing this agreement. The two key issues that we find in evaluating the reasons for judgment are that basically crediting, after the sale, as you may recall, that on November 1st, a second note was confected. While the first note had guarantors, particularly Brown, which is the most solvent of the parties involved, and the key to having the deal, the sale, go through, a reliance on Mr. Brown as the guarantor, a second note signed. That second note signed on November 1st, which was supposed to be the closing, the actual closing. This note had the guarantors, no longer the guarantors, had the Kell sign it, $325,000, identical amount, unlike the purchase money note, which had an interest left in blank. This note had a 15% interest. The Performance Group and Greenberg was known for issuing 15% notes. In fact, Smith and Co-West, from time to time borrowed money through Greenberg, and was, it's always inevitably 15% interest. He expected it to be 15%, his lawyer did, Mr. Raymond is here, and in fact, the Kells must have realized it's 15% because they signed a 15% note, just to the wrong people. Where we feel the court is incorrect in its findings is that it's crediting the second note to the first note. And as we argued in our brief, you can't have a second note taking over from a first note. In ruling 69 and ruling 16, he says the payments on the second note discharge the first note. In order for that to happen, there would have to be a novation. You can't just have a unilateral signing of a second note. I mean, we'd all like to go and give our brother-in-law, you know, a note in lieu of our homeowner's mortgage to the bank. Oh yeah, we'll just pay this other person. It's ludicrous. The novation, you know, their requirements of novation, which just weren't met. The second, as a related argument we have is that they're finding Greenberg an agent of Scott Smith, a double agent, he calls him, you know, with the Kells and Scott Smith, but he's obviously, if not in partnership, very close with Brown and Mr. Eaton.
Mr. Tate, didn't Judge Berryhill find in his written ruling that Mr. Smith himself had testified that Mr. Greenberg was working on his behalf?
Oh, without question. At that time, he was unaware of the second note. At that time, as you may recall, the ski rancher's house, he wanted that down payment to be able to close on that house for his home. He'd been living there for 2 years. Built up a considerable equity, if in calling in, wound up being compelled to sell it, it was about another $600,000 extra now from his original contract purchase price. In fact, there's writing in there about the time of the closing of the ski ranch's house, and he thinks the down payment, the $270,000, he thinks that Brown came through and on his guarantee and paid the darn thing, the $270 on his note, the amount owed on his note. He had no idea of the machinations going on. In connection with that, not only has he lost, the business has been lost, but now the actions are being taken by Brown on the guarantee. And remember, Brown is still here. Well, he actually not. He took off for about 4 years in Italy right after that. He disappeared about the same time as Greenberg, but he had a presence here enough that we tagged him before we left. To find an agency like that, if you look at the second page, that's not much of an agency, collection. Number two, if you look at and see just what happened on the second note, you have, they take a collateral security assignment, Exhibit 13-139-178, which is in violation of CRS 18-5-207, purchase on credit to defraud. They start selling the furnishings out. They close the Norwood office. They get rid of the staff there. They sell the furniture. No money gets to the seller.
Mr. Tate, let me go back a minute to what I think you're arguing, which is whether or not the trial court properly concluded that Mr. Greenberg was acting as an agent on behalf of ProWest.
That's fair.
Is it not correct that we review that determination for an abuse of discretion by the trial court?
That is, I'm not sure, because basically what we're talking about is private law. We're talking about contract law, and private law is generally, as I cited in my brief,
we're talking about agency law.
The agency, any type of agency is placed, if there is any, on the second page of that note. Now, as far...
Second page of Exhibit 11, you're talking about?
Exactly, that's right, second page.
And doesn't that show that the, at least some money was to be held on the Smith's behalf by the performance group?
And if you look at Escure...
Is that correct?
Yes, but that's...
Not paid to Smith directly?
That is basically, as you can see in the Escure correspondence, he's supposed to have a real estate...
I'm just looking at the promissory note, the second page of it.
Right, mm-hmm. I mean, I don't see, it as a...
Distribution is as follows, number one, if you drop down to C, $140,000 advance to be deposited with the performance group. Now, that's money that they're to hold that I assume was to go to the Smiths.
The...
Is that not right?
Okay, basically, they were supposed to cash out, and...
It says deposited.
Okay, but it also, wasn't that the payment before? Hold on, I'll go on.
That was on or before October 28th, 1998. We're dealing with an agency relationship.
Right. This, okay, again, now we get into other situation, but okay, this, okay, where was the money? There was never any money. And even the judge said, there, in his holding in paragraph 58, no evidence of any money was ever, he found no evidence that any money was ever on deposit with the performance group. They were gone.
Okay, but we're talking about an agency relationship. What Greenberg did or did not do, I assume he was not a party to this litigation.
It was already in default by that point, because the money wasn't brought up. The promises to come up with the money. The primary purpose of this thing was to get a closing on the house. And they breached that.
The promissory note did not state that this money was to go directly to the Smiths.
Well, you have a note that's payable to order, okay? And it says, in any case, it's payable not later than 24 months. If you look at the note in its entirety, which I am arguing stridently that the court finds a negotiable instrument. He found it was promised to pay, and we have, and it should, in any case, it's like a 24-month deal.
Yeah, and it says $250,000 of the $300,000 deposited with the performance group will be invested with the performance group for a 24-month term.
Right.
And you're saying that doesn't create an agency relationship or provide record support for the trial court so funding?
Well, I can say this. There was no $250,000. I mean,
some amount close to that?
Not even close. Not even close. $25,000. They had to come up with another $25,000. They came up with the $25,000 in December to get his house as a default, because they defaulted on his house. They weren't forwarding on that.
Does that change the analysis of whether this is an agency relationship?
If you look now, as far as the note itself, I think that's a question of law, and that's for y'all to decide. Now, as to the fact as to whether there ever actually was an agency, I think it's very plain that once that thing was signed on October 15th, he's gone, and he's never coming back. And at that time, on November 1st, I'll say who the agent who muscled that company, and that is Mr. Brown. Mr. Brown first got the security agreement in violation of 18-5-207, and then he put himself on November 1st, the same time this bogus second note was signed, he became the sole signatory of the agency checking account. He took over everything. He's an agent. If he's supposed to be the agent, I mean, it's not Greenberg. Greenberg's gone.
Mr. Tate, you have about 3 minutes left.
Thank you. Basically, in order for the rulings, you look at the rulings by the judge, his holdings, by paragraph, you have, he found no evidence was ever deposited. could not trace any Mueller money. You know, they claim there's money coming from Mueller. He's crediting the second note with the first note under 4-3-602. That is patently wrong because there's only one person who could have forced that note, the real note, the purchase money note, and that was Smith and Coest. The argument by opposing counsel that 4-3-117, that the second note was in fact the second note was a modification of the agreement. Well, that's great. Smith never even knew it was around for years until it's long been paid. The novation requirements, you know, are clearly set out. There are four of them. That's set out in Moffitt County State Court. A contract of novation has four requisites: a previously valid obligation, first note, the purchase money note, the real one, an agreement between the parties to abide by the new contract. Smith couldn't, he didn't even know about it. A valid new contract, that's valid. If that was tried on a savings institution, they'd be in jail for 10 years. And the extinguishment of the old obligation by the substitution. They kept trying to get the note from him. He kept it in a safety deposit box. Smith was not giving up that note. He had a guarantee on it. Again, under Moffitt County Bank, a pre-existing obligation must be extinguished, so there's not a novation. Anything remaining of the original obligation prevents a novation. Payments on that first note were made after November 1st, in spite of the holding that, you know, in 69, that, okay, he had to pay Smith. Then on November 1st, he had to pay, you know, these other guys. And then when it was finally taken out by Eaton, he had to pay Eaton. Well, heck, Smith and Coles got payments in November, in December, in February. You know, if there's a novation, if they didn't have to pay it, why are they paying it? You know, and the interest, no interest. That's not supposed to be an interest. But they were paying interest payments. And it's all coming out of the same income stream, the agency. And I'm running out of time here, but just very quickly, amendment should have been granted. It was filed timely within the standing orders. The court costs, we got 3 out of 4 defendants, and we have to pay all the costs. Brown tagged the Kells.
Your time is up, okay. Mr. Tate.
My prayer, please. I would seek a ruling on the contract on a 15% interest from Bates due, because that's what was expected of the buyer and was accepted by the seller. At the very minimum, from the time the Bates due, and alternatively, legal interest from the time each date was due, compounded annually in accordance with the statutory interest cited. And we would seek to allow remand back to, we'd like a judgment on what's due on the note, and we'd like a remand down to include, to allow amendment, including COCA and other claims that we were trying to get in the first place.
Thank you, Your Honor. Counsel?
Just a second here to
Sure. Get
all my papers set up. May it please the court, my name is Michael Gilbert. I represent the appellant, Stuart Brown. I'm going to be taking 13 minutes, leave 12 for Mr. Kell to speak. Every one of the issues here on appeal that has been raised is...
That would leave 2 minutes for Mr. Kell.
13 and 2. See, my math is bad. Hopefully it'll be better as I make my argument, but thank you. Every issue that you're facing here in this appeal is reviewed for an abuse of discretion. There are no legal errors that have been pointed out. Every one of the findings below is based on intensive factual analysis by the district court. There is no doubt that this transaction is an incredibly screwed up deal with a lot of moving parts, and no one is going to dispute that. And I think that Judge Berryhill said the same thing. But the trial court did a great job of weeding through all the evidence. Its findings are based on the facts. I'd like to go right to this issue of discharge, which I think is what the court was focused on. And the court's correct. There's one note, Exhibit 11. It's ultimately replaced by Exhibit 20. We contended below that that is an equitable novation. The court skinned the cat in a little different way and found that the Exhibit 11 note was discharged under 43602 of the UCC by payment, which was something we pled, although appellants claimed that we hadn't pled it. It is in our answer. It was addressed in opening argument with the court. The court really went to the heart of the case in so finding. I mean, the Kells, the evidence is undisputed, paid $645,000 to purchase this insurance agency. The Exhibit 11 note, as Judge Furman pointed out, explicitly says how that money is to be paid. It's going to be paid to the performance group, who's going to hold it for 2 years and invest it on Mr. Smith's behalf. $300,000 of the money is going to be held. $250,000 is going to be invested in some unknown investment. $25,000 is going to be paid out in cash, and the evidence is undisputed that that money was, in fact, paid to Mr. Smith.
Mr. Gilbert, just a quick factual question. If the Kells paid over $600,000 for the insurance agency and the promissory notes that are in Exhibits 11 and 20 were for $325,000, was the rest of what they paid just interest?
Yes, and there were points as well, Your Honor. Okay. If you look at the Exhibit 20 note, it talks about a kicker payment at the end of 24 months of $454,000 and somewhat change. So we've got interest, the points, et cetera. It was ultimately paid after the Exhibit 20 note comes in, which is a little bit after closing. For a year, interest payments are paid on a, I call it the tripartite note, which is Exhibit 20. That note is subsequently renegotiated over to Warren Eaton. The rest of the money is paid to him. There's no dispute about those cash payments. The district court found...
Mr. Gilbert, let me just ask you a more fundamental question. How was Exhibit 11 paid?
It was paid because, well, it was paid in two ways, one of which the district court found and one of which the district court didn't find, but with the evidence supports. When you look at the note, what it requires the deposit of money to the performance group. Finding 56 of the trial court's ruling, contrary to no hard money coming in, the court finds $270,833 had been traced into the performance group's accounts. Initially, a deposit of $162,000 and $162,500 by Mr. Brown, $108,333 by Warren Eaton. So those are the private investors that are funding this transaction. There is deposition testimony from Eric Mueller that talks about a Mueller-Turner investment with the performance group. What Mr. Mueller testified was that he was told that by Greenberg that part of the $1 million that they had invested with the performance group was put into this deal. When that money comes in from those three sources, Exhibit 11 is satisfied. What the note requires is the money to be deposited with the performance group. The problem with this transaction and the problem with the note, and it's a problem that was identified by Smith's counsel before this deal was done, was the note never talks about how Smith is supposed to get his money out of the performance group. It's one of the reasons this is such a screwy deal. But there's a reason for that, and I pointed out in the briefs, Your Honors. At the time Smith did this deal, he was broke, he wasn't filing tax returns, he had judgment and IRS liens against him, he hadn't drawn a salary in 10 years. I mean, he could not receive the money from this transaction or it goes to his creditors. Ergo, Lance Greenberg, who there is no doubt was a con man involved in running sort of a Ponzi scheme down in Telluride, and he left town in February of 99 with a whole bunch of other people's money. We have the testimony of Mr. Beiser, the AUSA out of Washington, who Smith confided in terms of investigating a RICO action that was pending against Greenberg. And Smith tells him, well, Lance took my money. When you look at the testimony in the record and what happened here, Smith got paid $75,000 out of this pot of money. every single payment is made directly by the performance group, nobody else. The Kells never pay Smith a nickel. So Smith looks to the performance group to get his money. The note says the money is going to be deposited with them. And ultimately what happens, and this is, I think, answering your question, is how is it paid? Exhibit 11 gets made, which is a document that was always contemplated by the parties to this transaction. I mean, maybe not that specific document, but everybody knew that Exhibit 11 was a temporary note. It was going to be replaced by other documents. If you look at the record at 725, the appellant says it was only, this is Exhibit 11, a temporary note to secure the sale of the agency until the Kells lender, Lance Greenberg, Performance Group, could come up with some money. He did. The money was deposited. As soon as that money hits the books, Exhibit 11 is paid. That's one way to find it.
And that's when he went out to get the other investors.
No, the investors are the ones that put the money into the performance group to begin with. I mean, the money comes in on October 14th from Brown, 162.5. Eaton pays 108 in December of 99, which is, again,
Turner was also an investor? Of
yes, Turner and Mueller, California people that gave Greenberg a power of attorney, and their testimony in the deposition, it's in volume 11, I think, of the transcript, is, yeah, he told us we were in this deal, and they were getting some interest checks for a period until Eaton bought out the note. So the note is funded, and that is a fact. I mean, the facts support that. The facts also clearly support that Greenberg was appointed the agent of Smith. I mean,
let me just ask a quick question.
Yes.
However, Exhibit 11 was never canceled or marked paid in full or obviously destroyed or anything
correct.
Else.
You're right. And had it been surrendered as it should have been and the Kells were asking for, we would clearly have an ovation. I mean, there'd be no question. But we don't. So the issue is, you know, is there an equitable ovation? I argue that in closing. I think there was. I think there's case law, although not in Colorado, elsewhere that supports that under these facts. But I think you can also look to exactly what the district court did. I mean, there's a lot of ways to skin this cat. And the district court, frankly, went right to the heart of it and said, I'm going to look at this deal and figure out what was intended and what actually happened. And that's what he did. And he saw lots of letters from Smith's lawyer saying, Greenberg's got my money. He's going to hold the money. He's going to broker this deal. I've cited them in the briefs. Smith himself said Greenberg didn't pay him. That was the whole problem here. That's who Smith was looking for, to pay him. So what the court finds is, okay, Smith appoints Greenberg agent. Greenberg eventually sort of negotiates this obligation over to Eaton and tells the Kells, you're supposed to pay Eaton. And they do until September of 2004 when they've paid it in full. The trial court's finding is that they performed in good faith under the reasonable belief that this is what they should be doing. And I think that's supported by the entire structure of the transaction and the documents. More importantly, that, of course, is a finding of fact reviewed for an abuse of discretion. And I don't think you can look at this record and find that in any way the trial court abused its discretion. As to the law, I mean, you look at the cases that we've cited, the Burrick versus Hubbard case, and especially that Stockyards versus Neubauer case, where, you know, on facts kind of similar, although it's hard to find a fact pattern that matches this one, I'll grant you that. But you've got, basically in those cases, you've got a payor on a note that's paying the wrong person. And that's basically what Smith's allegation is here. Well, they should have been paying me. But what the Stockyards case says is, look, when somebody is performing an obligation under good faith and they pay somebody that they think is the rightful holder of the obligation or entitled to collect it, an agent in that case of the holder of the note, and the ultimate holder has empowered the agent to receive that money, put that agent in the middle of the mess, then who's going to bear the risk of loss there? And in a sense, that's what this court is looking at here, although I think it's a discretionary finding by the district court, and you can't find on this record an abuse of discretion, But what Judge Berryhill said is, look, under these facts, I can't order these guys to pay twice. I mean, they acted reasonably under the circumstances. Smith empowered and put Greenberg in the driver's seat on the deal, and he's going to have to bear the consequences of this. He also got the payments from Greenberg, and we have his testimony that it wasn't paid. But frankly, under this set of facts, who knows? I mean, we've been able to trace a lot of the money coming into the performance group. We know Greenberg left town, but we don't know what he took with him when he left. So, you know, I think that's what we're looking at as to the other issues. I mean, they're all discretionary in the trial court, whether Berryhill properly tried the case. The amendment issue, I think we've covered with, you know, harmless error, and I don't think they ever filed an appropriate motion to amend. So, you know, and there are alternative grounds which we've argued in our papers with respect to affirming this. I mean, when you look,
Mr. Gilbert, let me just ask you about that. As I understand your notice of cross appeal and the arguments you raise on cross appeal, they're not really a true cross appeal in the sense that you're asking for more relief, but they're just alternative bases to affirm.
There are, exactly.
Berryhill, is that correct?
That's exactly right, Your Honor. And there are really two of them.
Right.
One is discharged by amendment of the interest rate on the note. I think their papers, even in this court, have said, well, hey, he was promised 15% orally by Greenberg on the note, which discharges the guarantor's liability, Mr. Brown's. And the second is statute of limitations. I mean, the district court found this to be a negotiable instrument. I take issue with that finding. I think you can look at this thing and say, I mean, the idea of taking that into a bank and negotiating it never, ever happened.
You're at about 2.5 minutes if you're going to save some time for Mr.
I'm going to save some time unless the court has any further questions. Basically, in conclusion, I think that the district court did a terrific job. We've got a lot of factual findings. We have no abuse of discretion. We would ask for an affirmance.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Kell, Mr. Gilbert has, in fact, left you with 14 seconds.
And yes, I know. Yeah. I did want the original 12 minutes he asked for, believe me. Your Honor, I am Kevin Kell, and my wife and I are representing pro se today, as you're well aware. May it please the court, I'd just basically like to go to the heart of the matter, which for us is the discharge of the $325,000 promissory note. The lower court made the finding that we had acted in good faith. And in fact, the lower court went out of its way to point out in its findings that we had fulfilled our duty of good faith between 1998 and 2004. Your Honor, we've paid for this agency. We made payments, as the court found, and it's undisputed that we made payments in excess of $645,000 with principal, interest, and points for this agency. And I believe Judge Berryhill was correct in his assertion that in his finding that the law was never intended to make somebody pay twice for the same transaction. We acted in good faith. We made the payments we were believed we were supposed to make according to the sales documents, the payments we were told to make, and paid off the agency. The lower court's finding that the note has been discharged by payment to the appellant's agent, we believe is correct. And this business, is our livelihood, and we don't believe that we should have to pay for it twice. In conclusion, the appellant has failed in its duty to prove that the lower court abused its discretion in making its findings of fact. The only valid basis for reversing the lower court's decision, of course, is an abuse of discretion. And we respectfully ask the court to uphold and affirm the lower court's decisions. And with that, Your Honor, I appreciate your time, and I would be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Is there any indication, and I don't recall or remember this from the brief, but is there any indication that some payments that you made to Mr. Greenberg actually made it through to Mr. Smith?
Well, Your Honor, the payments that we were making on Exhibit 20, the replacement note, mm-hmm. What I call it, actually were going to an account and to the people who loaned us the money, Mr. Brown, Mr. Eaton, and originally the performance group. So we had an account. I'm sorry, my time's up. Would you like me to finish answering, Your Honor?
If you know, did any of the money get through to Mr. Smith?
No, it wasn't intended to, Your Honor. It was to go to the three people who loaned us the money.
People that you had borrowed
the. Oh, yes. There is testimony and evidence in the record, Your Honor, that shows that the, as Mr. Gilbert said that the money went to the performance group, and so I don't know of any payments that went directly, except the ones in the record that went directly to Mr. Smith.
Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Kell, and thank you, counsel, for both sides. Thank you for your arguments, and this matter will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. That concludes our docket for this afternoon.